Good morning.
Good morning.
Today is the 8th of April 2008, and I'm now with Mrs. Elizabeth McClintock, who is a lead facilitator with the Burundi Leadership Training Program, BLTP, with CM Partners. Right? We're in Bujumbura, the capital of Burundi. Well, first, thank you for your time. And before we start the interview, I'd like you to please confirm that you've given your consent.
Yes, I have given my consent.
All right, thank you. Well, I'd like to start the interview by learning a little bit more about your personal background and maybe the jobs you held before this position, and particularly about the program you're involved in here in Burundi and how it relates to the police.
Okay. My training is in negotiation, conflict management, communication skills training. I have my master's degree from the Fletcher School at Tufts University. And after leaving Tufts, I joined Conflict Management Group, which was a spin-off of Roger Fisher's work at the Harvard Negotiation Project at Harvard University. And worked at Conflict Management Group for almost 10 years as a trainer, as a consultant, working predominantly in the public sector. And it was through that work that I met Howard Wolpe. He was President Clinton's former special envoy to the Great Lakes region and the Arusha peace process. And Howard recruited me to be the lead facilitator for a rather innovative leadership program that he was developing in his role as director of the Africa program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. So Howard wanted very much to look at the possibility of better supporting leaders in post-conflict states, and by that, trying to help them rebuild relationships, create more confidence amongst the leaders who would be responsible for taking a country forward in a post-conflict period, particularly during periods of transition, helping them to acquire the skills and tools necessary to focus on agreeing on new rules of the game, if you will. And my role in this project has been to help with the development of the training program and to implement that training program. So with colleagues from IRENE, which is a negotiation institute at ESSEC Business School in Paris, I developed with Howard the core of the training program. And since early 2003, where we first started with leaders of very mixed backgrounds. So six of the seven former rebel groups, former government, army, gendarme, political parties, civil society, including youth, women, religious leaders. The idea was to bring together approximately 100 of Burundi's key leaders at the time of the transition. So this is after the signature of the Arusha Accords, but before the ceasefire with the CNDD-FDD. So the conflict had not essentially really ended actively on the ground. So the purpose was to bring them together to restore confidence, build their skill set, and help them to agree on some new rules of working together, if you will, in this post-conflict context. And one other innovative aspect of the program was that Howard and the team did not choose those people. Burundians themselves and the international community who had been working with Burundians chose those people. So our process was to interview as many people as possible and get them to suggest the 35 people they felt were key to Burundi's transition in the next 2 to 5 years. So of that, we got a list of between 300 and 400 names, and from that list, approximately 100 overlapped significantly, you know, many people getting significant numbers of votes. And we did a series of workshops training 95 leaders including an initial retreat where we left Bujumbura, and some people who participated the first time they'd been back in Burundi in 30 years since leaving after the 1972 massacres. So it was a fairly significant event, and I think quite timely. And Howard's motivating factor was most definitely that what he had witnessed at Arusha was some goodwill, but very little ability, because of lack of skill set, to actually have the conversations necessary to think about, once the agreement was signed, what did implementing the agreement actually look like? How would that actually happen? And he had tried to sell this idea of doing training with the parties to the agreement prior to the signature of the accords, but that didn't fly, really, with the mediation, the facilitation at the time, which initially were the Tanzanians, and then that was handed off to Mandela after Nyerere's death. So he succeeded, however, later in raising the funds and getting the agreement of sort of the international community and of course the Burundians to do this work. So that's really what started it. I made a decision to join the program more or less full time because for me it offered an opportunity. Doing training in negotiation and conflict management is very interesting and can be quite useful, but this was really a first opportunity to be on the ground for a sustained period of time to see what the real impact might be with parties in a post-conflict context. So, as you can imagine, if the topic is police, meant some of the people that we trained initially were from the military, certainly. I'm trying to remember if we initially had anyone from the gendarmerie. Probably not, but there was a lot of interest on the part of the military at the end of this initial series of workshops, and the then Army Chief of Staff, who is now the Minister of Defense, said that he would like to have us work specifically with the CNDD-FTD, who were in the process of finalizing the accords with the government, the ceasefire accords. And they came, the CNDD-FTD came from the bush in Tanzania, and the ex-FAB officers came from the front lines here in Burundi, and we met in Nairobi in November 2003, just prior to the ceasefire agreement being signed. And then subsequent to that, with all the necessary aspects of the accord being put into practice, so the reform of the army, the creation, literally, of the new national police force, we got involved in training both high command of the police and the high command of the army, who were responsible for the reform process, and then training officers in both the police and the army subsequent to that. So the project has been going since March 2003, as I mentioned. Initially funded by the World Bank, then some funding by USAID, a bit of funding by the European Commission, and this, most of the funding for our work with the police, the lion's share has been DFID, so the British government. And that funding just ended in March. In the meantime, however, the BLTP ceased being a project of the Wilson Center and became an official NGO. It's a Burundian NGO now, and has its own identity, here in Burundi, and is now seeking funding for other projects. Just so you know, we don't only do work with the security sector. In fact, our work has predominantly been with government and the public sector, if you will. We've trained political parties, trained the government, most recently brought together the four former heads of state, heads of the political parties, heads of the army, minister of interior, director general of the police, etc., to look at sort of trying to unblock one of the most recent political impasses. There was slight improvement, but I think there's yet work to be done. So that sort of is the background and where the project comes from.
Okay. You mentioned that the Army Chief of Staff asked for specific training related to the reform of the army.
Yes.
Is this also where the training for the newly created Police Nationale Burundaise came from? And is this in addition to the originally 100 or so identified leaders?
Yes, it's an addition to the original 100 that we trained. And by training, I mean a series of workshops, follow-up activities, etc. So not just a one-off event, but a series of workshops and gatherings, activities over the course of 18 months. That was the original group. From that, the Army Chief of Staff at the time asked us to work with the soldiers who came from literally the battlefield. And it was from that group where, for example, so Minister Bignoni participated in that group in November 2003. And Director General Ndayishimiye also participated in that group in November 2003. So when the minister, well, the current Minister of Defense, then Army Chief of Staff, started focusing on the Army, the police, or those charged with the creation and the reform of the security sector, but the creation of the National Police, decided that they too would like to benefit from this. So in the Army was a bit better organized, honestly, and there were more resources focused on that process. So that work got started immediately at the beginning of 2004. With the police, we started our work with the Police High Command in February of 2005. That year, we trained approximately 70 officers charged with more or less the reform process of the National Police. And then a bit of a hiatus. We turned towards working more with political parties and, again, the Army. And then the police came back to us and asked for further training. And this last year, in 2007, I trained approximately 70 more officers from the National Police. And I've now trained, 37 trainers within the National Police Force. So we designed and implemented training of trainers. And this corresponds to Emmanuel, who is the commissaire for charged with training within the National Police, which was newly created in December of 2007, corresponds to some of his goals. So we're trying now to see if we can support the National Police in integrating this training into their regular offering for agents, brigadiers, and officers within the National Police Force.
We'll get back to the specifics of the different trainings with the Police Nationale Burundaise. But before that, you mentioned early on that the first idea by Horde Wolpe came out of the fact that he identified a number of necessary skill sets. Can you tell us a little bit about what are maybe the main challenges that were identified at the time? And how was the training designed to respond to maybe some specific needs of the leaders in general?
Right. How Howard Wolpe viewed not his participation, but rather he observed during the Arusha process that it was very difficult for leaders to come together to have the necessary discussions about substantive issues. And his premise, based on his work as a longtime member of Congress, having worked in politics and also just in government in general for many years, he realized that one of the challenges folks would have would be not getting their signature on the accord, but assuring that the accord was actually implemented later. And he felt strongly that the process of getting the accord signed could serve as a first step in building the relationships necessary to ensure that the the implementation of the Accords might go a bit more smoothly. Again, as I mentioned earlier, unfortunately that was not possible. It was not possible. He offered the idea up and suggested that they do some training of the actual negotiators. But that idea was put aside for the moment for many reasons, I think. I think Nyerere and Mandela both felt that there just wasn't, I think it was actually under Nyerere that he proposed the original idea, but there just wasn't the time to do it, and people felt that there weren't, ironically, the relationships necessary to get people to get in the same room and do some of this skill building. So, after the Accords were signed and after he joined the Wilson Center, he continued to develop the idea and talk about it with Burundians. And in fact, all of the work that we've done through the Burundi Leadership Training Program has been asked for by Burundians themselves. So in terms of getting buy-in for the idea of the project, certainly he came to them and proposed an idea, but he didn't move forward without people's buy-in. That includes predominantly Burundians and, of course, the international community as well. So that's been a major, I think, advantage of this program, is we don't just sort of come and impose an idea. So the challenges that he noticed, one is in a situation, post-conflict context, where after you've had, 13 years of civil war, people have no trust, literally no trust. And it's very difficult to ask a government of transition to function without even a modicum of trust. No real relationships amongst the key players. They had been outside of the country, perhaps polarized in camps because of, that in a figurative sense, not literal. But in their different ideological camps because of clearly concrete events on the ground. So that ethnic and regional polarization made it very difficult to imagine that people would be able to come together suddenly after the Accords were signed and make a government function, because the government was a government of transition, which by its very nature meant that you were mixing people in who had not necessarily worked together before. He felt strongly that people needed to agree on the rules of the game, and nothing in any peace process, not simply the Arusha process, but in most international peace processes, there isn't a lot of time spent on helping the protagonists understand what does that mean in these new institutions, what are the rules and how do you agree upon them, and what, we talk about elections, but elections are really one moment in a very long period of time in the creation or the reform of institutions that are supposed to serve the people. So he felt very strongly that there was an opportunity to help people build the relationships, agree on the rules of the game, restore some confidence. And to do that, in war people scream at each other, they don't listen to one another, but when you get into democratic institutions like parliament or the assembly, people may take positions and they say that they're defending the interests of their constituents, yet they still need to be able to discuss issues. And there was no sense of any common interest, really, throughout the whole the Arusha process. And Howard wanted to bring that sense of your own interest can be found in part in the interest, satisfying the interests of the collective. So he came to me and to Conflict Management Group initially, and then subsequently I'm also managing partner in a small firm called CM Partners, which does similar training and consulting. And the idea was, how do you integrate some of these skills and tools developed at the Harvard Negotiation Project in negotiation, conflict management, strategic decision making, communication skills, leadership, if you will, into a longer term program that would at the same time try to rebuild relationships, establish some trust, and they could then use those skills to establish the new rules of the game. And that's precisely what we've been trying to do. And I would say it remains hugely challenging 5 years on. Some days I wonder if we've made any progress at all. Other days I'm more heartened when I speak to Some of our participants, those with whom I've worked longer, but it's challenging. You don't change people's behavior in a day, and I think in the West we have a tendency to think that democracy is kind of one way, and it isn't. There's many ways to achieve what we might want to call democratic ideals, and assisting or kind of lending a hand to those who are reforming institutions within their own countries can be a very challenging process, I think.
The BLTP is a cross-sectoral project. It targets different leaders in different institutions. How does it relate to maybe other programs that have been implemented here, other training programs that might be more targeted at specific institutions such as the military or the police?
Right. We do our very best. Particularly, we've been more successful with the police and the military. We've done a little bit of work with Parliament and are aware of, for example, other training programs for parliamentarians. There you might find like an NDI or an IRI, which gives very specific advice on how do you write a bill, procedures, operational things that need to happen in Parliament. That's definitely not our expertise. And so the same is true in the Army or the police, for example, where we're not trying to necessarily help them develop their code of conduct or train people on crowd control, all those things that are necessary in a well-functioning police. Yet we do remain in very close contact, and I think one thing that's happened more effectively here in Burundi than my understanding of other places is that we do relatively regularly meet as resource persons from donor-funded programs to support, say, the reform of the police. So I am aware of who is the head of the Belgian Technical Cooperation, the former head of Belgian Technical Cooperation, Kaim, observed our trainings. I've observed the trainings that they've undertaken, the training of trainers that they've done. We found that our methodology in terms of and the pedagogy is very similar, which is very nice, which means that if we're all training trainers, they're at least being trained with a similar pedagogy in mind, even though the content is not necessarily the same. That's normal. But our emphasis on how officers work with their participants, et cetera, at least is the same. Also know and try to coordinate with the Dutch and the French. And we also, the same is true on the military side, where we try at least to be informed, coordinate, and then invite observers from the different programs to our training programs as well, so that there is some, it's an informational thing less than sort of a truly collaborative effort, in the sense that we don't necessarily share the same content, so there's less of a need to be fully collaborative. However, there is a great need to be consultative and inform each other of what we're doing. And we see ourselves very much as a small part of a much larger process, of course, of reform in the security sector. So, for example, now within the Army, this training program, I just finished training 16 more officers. So there are 26 officers within the La Force de Défense Nationale who are trained as trainers, including the director of studies at ENSCOM. So he's now in this latest group of officers who are going through their 9-month training. We'll add on at the end this training, and they'll do the training themselves. I won't do it, which is the whole purpose, we're hoping that the same will be true in the police, but the commissariat for training has only just been established. So they're still trying to figure out exactly what their schedule is, how do they want to integrate things. But we had a fairly successful, a successful training in February of trainers, so of the national police. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to also move that forward.
Okay. I'd like now to talk more specifically about the police part of the training. However, some question might be more general, and then you're welcome to draw on all of the different experiences from trainings. So first, can you describe more in details the kind of training that we dispense to police officers of all levels, and particularly on how they differ from the previous leadership training that you were describing for the original 100 leaders.
Mm-hmm. Okay. First of all, just a note on levels, we've targeted only officers within the police. We've not yet worked with brigadiers or agents, and mm-hmm. we probably will not, given that that training would be offered in Kirundi. So that's one of the purposes of training trainers. So now our next step is to try and figure out how to best support them and integrate this into some sort of training program that is, of course, amenable to the overall training program of the National Police.
So the training of officers is done in French then?
Yes. The content of the training is very much what I described to you. So we look at developing an awareness of all participants, and this includes the police, of course, of their own attitude towards negotiation. When I talk about negotiation, and this takes a little bit of explaining in this particular context in Burundi, we speak about negotiation with a small N, not a capital N, because people tend to think of negotiations and immediately think of all things Arusha. Negotiations are when two parties come together to solve a national or international crisis, as opposed to thinking about negotiation as simply an opportunity to influence someone else to get them to join your particular effort, and that could be negotiating with your colleagues for the implementation of a particular project, negotiating with your superior for a new post, etc. So we try to distinguish there. But it's really looking at the skills. First, we start with their own awareness about their own attitudes towards collaboration, communication, negotiation. And we do this through exercises and simulations. Initially, the exercises and simulations have nothing to do with the contents of what you might think a police training might be about. They're much more generic, and the purpose of that is to get people to focus on the concept as opposed to the context. If you offer a simulation right at the beginning when you're first working with folks that has to do with the intervention of the police in a particular situation here in Bujumbura, they're going to argue with you about all the details you got wrong, about what actually happened, about why the police would or would not do certain things, et cetera. And that's not our purpose. Our purpose is not sort of to judge the veracity of a simulation. The purpose is to use the simulation as a vehicle for presenting certain concepts about communication, leadership, how to exercise leadership, under what circumstances, et cetera. So we very much start with much more generic exercises and simulations. And the reason this particular set of skills has been offered to the police is the police have asked us for those skills because they recognize in a post-conflict context when you are not actually recruiting at this stage members of the police force, you are taking ex-combatants and you're creating a new force from formerly belligerent parties. And that's a very different prospect. And since a major piece of the Arusha process was the reform of the security sector and ensuring ethnic, regional, and other balance within the sector, political appartenance and all this, it changes the nature of the need. So one need is simply, how do I collaborate with this person who was formerly my enemy? And that's really where the BLTP is best positioned to offer skill building and training. So we focus on, what does it mean to be collaborative without being concessionary? What does it mean to understand the interests of those, your colleagues, and how do you build a better police force based on your understanding of those interests? How do you as an officer behave so that your behavior has a positive impact on those men and women under your command. And frankly, we spend a lot of time on understanding perceptions. Where do your perceptions of this other person come from? How do you manage those partisan perceptions? How do you then communicate in a way that gets you what you need and what you want, rather than, and even in a hierarchical structure where giving orders is a perfectly acceptable and normal way of proceeding, communication still, I would say, in the evaluation that we've done, both of our work with FDN and our work with the National Police Force, they cite communication skills as their one of the most important things they've taken away. Active listening, of all things. How do you actually listen to your subordinate, to your fellow officer, to your superior, in a way that gives you the information that you need to do what you, your job more effectively, to be a more effective leader, essentially. So we then move them through a process where the simulations become more complicated and more closer to real life. So then they might end a training program where they've negotiated a hostage situation. And it's not based here in Burundi. And it may not even totally be a police situation, but it's the idea is that it gets them to think about using the skills and tools in a more real-life situation. We also then, through follow-up workshops and other activities, share a couple of analytical tools with them, just ways of thinking about solving problems in the immediate term. Not necessarily major conflicts, but just a problem between two officers under your command or two brigadiers under your command, or not even necessarily within the context of the police, but in your quartier, you know, out in the community in which you live and work. How do you better communicate with the population? If we're really talking about a police à proximité, what does that mean? And we talk a lot about how these skills and tools can then be applied to help them realize their, sort of bring to life the code of conduct that they've written for themselves, the déontologie de la police. Okay, what is, we understand what that means in theory, but what does it really mean in practice? And so the BLTP's role is to help them better understand that there are some very specific skills and tools that can help them convey that to their own men and women and to the population at large. So the analytical tools are very simple, straightforward, and tend to help them solve immediate problems. So that's kind of how the program moves forward. As you can imagine, the skills and tools that we share with the police are the same ones that we share with the army, are the same ones that we share with the parliamentarians, are the same ones that we shared with the four heads of state. The differences begin to come towards the end of each workshop or each activity, where we move from theoretical or simulated environments to more real life problem solving. And then we do not pretend to comment on whether or not this fits within the police. You have to have police experts to sort of say, you know, these are more feasible solutions to problems. But the Burundians themselves are able to, a lot of good sense and expertise exists. What we try to provide is a better process for getting at those decisions more effectively, more efficiently.
So who carries out the training? You mentioned that there were originally 70 officers trained starting in 2005. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, the 70, but there's also training of trainers happening. Mm-hmm. So who is doing the training for the BLTP? And now, how did the transition happen from training officers to choosing to train trainers? Who are themselves officers.
Right. I do all the training. I think I've done all the training except for one workshop in 5 years. that, and I'm accompanied by a co-trainer. And that's one of the reasons I'm here, though, is to provide this resource to the program. Initially, my co-trainer was always from ESSEC Irénée in France. There, as you can imagine, there's always an issue of language. So I'm American, Fortunately, my French has improved. The training all takes place in French. And we realized very early on that if you wanted to have some sustainability in a program like this, you would have to ultimately train Burundians to become trainers so that it could also be offered in Kirundi. I've not talked about it, but there's a program that was funded by OTI in which I also figured as the lead facilitator, where we trained 20 Burundians who then went out and worked for 18 months in the provinces of Ruigi and Gitega, and they trained 7,000 local leaders. So based on that experience, I trained trainers and we developed a whole guide de formation that was then translated in Kirundi. So when, after having trained the initial group of officers in the police high command, and the same in parallel, this also happened at the Army, they said, we'd like to be able to share these skills and tools with officers, but we'd like to integrate them into our own training structure and program. So that's when the idea of training trainers came about. So while I remain the lead facilitator, because there is a fairly significant investment to, you can train trainers, but then you have to follow them. You have to be able to give them opportunities to train, give them constant feedback, etc. And that's where we are now, is trying to provide opportunities for those trained trainers to work and then give them feedback and then improve upon their own skill sets as trainers. And it's a challenge because I'm one person. Now in this office, the executive director, with whom I hope you'll speak later, is trained as a trainer, and he's now one of our principal trainers. So he's my co-trainer and is a very competent person, and we've trained of the 35 plus police officers that we've trained, there'll be a few, as in any case, who are really, really good and who will continue to carry this forward. The same is true in the Army.
Can you describe how different were the program in lengths and in nature from the original training of officers to now what you described, the more recent initiative to train 30 trainers? How long were the respective trainings, and how different are these?
Well, you can imagine. The first training, people get their first exposure to all these skills and exercises. It's generally a 6-day retreat followed by one or two follow-up workshops of 2 to 3 days each. So in 2005, we would have done 2 6-day retreats and between 2 and 4 follow-up workshops with the group. Of 70 trained officers. Same thing happened this last year. We did 2 6-day retreats, which were followed by each by 1 follow-up workshop. At the request of Director General Bignoni at the time, who is now the Minister of Public Security, we identified 2 groups of officers who would be trained as trainers. They had to have already participated in the training, because this was now going to be an opportunity for them, of course, to get up in front of the room and themselves prepare and present different aspects of the program. So that's a much longer, that's a 10-day, 9 to 10-day investment. It's very intense. And then that's followed by follow-up activities, depending on the availability of the trainers, depending on the availability of people to train. That's a much more intense process, training trainers. The first is interesting, and I think people get something out of it. That is, if you've ever participated in a management training course as part of, you know, a job that you might have had, it can, some things stick and some things don't. And we're very well aware of that, which is why we built in the follow-up activities. And I recognize, too, that we could have probably built in many more follow-up activities. It's a question of resources always and availability. What they've done, though, something that's very positive in the way the police and the military are structured, is that they have these causeries morales with brigadier and agents. So an officer might have under his command, you know, say 20 to 30 people I don't know exactly, it depends on what unit we're talking about, but they will do regular meetings where the whole idea is to get the people to talk about their problems, to talk about what's happening within the unit, what's happening, how do they share. And that, I think, has been where our training has been very useful in terms of maintaining morale, in improving relationships amongst, especially if you think about it, the level of the agent. These are former soldiers, all ex-combatants, and they've been asked to completely change their attitude vis-a-vis the population, vis-a-vis, you know, if you're out on the street and you see a police officer carrying, not an officer, but an agent carrying an AK-47, and you ask yourself, is this where community policing should be? That's a big mountain to climb for the National Police Force. There's still a lot of steps in the reform process that need to be undertaken. And if you speak to some of the police officers, they're not prepared to give up their guns because peace has not entirely come to the country, and so the police feel outgunned and outnumbered often by other forces, whether they're just bandits, you know, armed robbers, or if you're talking about the FNL, who've not yet come in and been demobilized.
The last rebel groups.
Yes.
So, as I understand, so the training was actually asked by the police, so I assume it was integrated into what they call their harmonization training, formation d'harmonisation?
It was in the Army. It was not so successfully structured into the police. In the Army, they did for the officers, our training became part of the harmonisation. In the police, well, we trained fewer officers to begin with, but we haven't had quite as much success in getting it quite as well integrated as we would like. Ultimately, yes, that is the goal, because the vast majority of policemen still have not been received all the training that they need, even the basic training that they're to have received, and this is supposed to be part of that process. But no, that integration process is not yet really come together as one would hope.
So this training on the police side of things is targeted at officers. So did all the training happen then in the institute in Bujumbura, and how did you make sure that the skills were transferred to the provinces as well?
Actually, no, the training all happened outside of Bujumbura. And frankly, in the choice of the initial choice of who gets to participate, that's also a very political decision. I mean, the whole process of reform is quite politicized in Burundi. So while I think some of the choices of who would be trained are very good ones, others are not. We don't have a lot of say. We give the criteria that we would hope that would be followed in the choice of officers who are going to be trained. But then, you know, there's also a lot of the reason it's politicized is because the process is not an easy one, the process of reform. It is a political process. So when you're trying to achieve ethnic regional balance, you're trying to make sure that promotions are well distributed. That means things like training, where it's considered a certain perk, not just the BLTP training, any kind of training, any sort of per diem you might receive as a result of that, the opportunity to enhance your own skill set is all going to go towards building your career and making it your career, making you more attractive in this process. So all those things considered, it's more challenging to imagine exactly than how that gets transferred to others. Our initial objective was not necessarily to have everyone go off and train others. Our initial objective, particularly with the initial group of the high command, was to improve their own relationships so that they could better manage the reform process. And that, I think, we had some success with. In other words, they worked more effectively with each other. And the whole reason was we took them outside of Bujumbura for 6 days, and they spent the night and ate together. And I think a lot of what happened afterwards at the canteen, having a beer, or during lunchtime or at dinner, as opposed to necessarily what's happening inside the classroom. That one of our purposes is to bring people together for a sustained period of time. And honestly, some of them didn't even know each other's first names. And so you have that opportunity to bring them together. So the initial purpose was not to have them go off and train others. It was as in light of that experience that people began to see that this might be a useful tool in terms of getting lower ranking officers and then policemen to participate in a program where it improved their relationships with those with whom they work.
So you said the BLTP suggested criteria for selection of the people who would participate. So you mentioned a number of things like is ethnic balance and...
That wasn't our criteria. That's their criteria. In other words...
Based on their research group.
Yeah, of course. That's what I meant when I said the process is politicized. It is because they do have certain... They have their own criteria to which they need to be responding. Mm-hmm.
What are some of the criteria you
suggested? Our criteria
suggested?
Much more in terms of who is going to really remain in the Corps for a sustained period of time rather than move on or be demobilized. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, that was very tough because it wasn't clear, even for high-ranking officers, who was going to remain, who was going to be demobilized. At the beginning, of course, is who would play a key role in the reform process. And again, our criteria are suggested. This is the choice of the Burundian government to participate in this program, and it's their choice of who should come, and that we absolutely accept that. And we felt that we had the opportunity to influence that decision through the suggestion of criteria. Also, thinking about who were in key posts that they might eventually have an impact through their own behavior on other officers. So are you talking maybe in a training context? That was much easier in the Army than in the police because, as I mentioned, they only just created the fourth commissariat in December, and it's directed towards training. We did one of the first, in 2006, one of the first trainers I trained was Salvatore Nahimana, so the head of the police institute. So he has the skills and tools, and he's tried to implement them within the institute, but it's hard without a lot of resources, and that wasn't necessarily the direction that our program had. The original idea was not necessarily to integrate directly into the academy, so therefore you have the Institute of Police, rather. It's just a question of resources, too. How much time and energy and money do you have to support all these new ideas that come out? But someone like Salvatore was a good choice because he remains in a training in terms of criteria. Ideally, the head of the institute would be a good choice if you want to sustain a training activity.
So you mentioned there were follow-ups.
Yes.
So especially for the trainers that have been trained, where is the retention rate, for instance, a year, 2 years down the road? You mentioned the issue of people maybe being demobilized or moving on to their career.
Yeah. I would say it's very similar to any training program. If you were to do a statistical analysis, they say, 30% actually leave the room with some significant... retention level where they go out and practice it, and then say 1 year down the line, you're probably down to 10%, honestly. So you might have, in a group of 30, you might have three people who are really applying it. I think we try to overcome that through the follow-up workshops so that we try to raise that level. It would be hard for me I couldn't tell you statistically exactly how many people, but honestly, for the trainers, I mean, we trained 9 in December and 23 in February, so December of 2007 and February of 2008. So that process has just now gotten started in light of the new commissariat. So honestly, I have more experience with the Army, and I've had more opportunities to bring them together and also to provide them with training opportunities. And it's only through providing them with training opportunities that they're going to retain it, particularly as trainers. And that's a tough one because... we're not a top priority for the military. That's understandable. I mean, I wouldn't even expect to be. So trying to do this one slice of training in a otherwise enormous program where you're trying to demobilize, you're trying to follow the World Bank's, in both these institutions, follow the World Bank's directives, if you want your debt relieved and bring the number of forces down to what's considered an acceptable number, and then also train up those who can't read and write, etc. So adapting all of your training programs. The BLTP, honestly, is pretty far down the line of priorities in terms of trying to figure out how to integrate it into their own programming.
So you said there's some integrated officers that do not know how to read and write?
Not officers, I'm talking about agents.
Oh, agents.
Yeah, I'm talking about the homme de troupe. No, all the officers.
So all these things considered, how well do you think the program is meeting the objectives set? And there, I mean, as you said, maybe on the police side is too early. But maybe from the experience with the military or the leaders?
I think one of the objectives, as I mentioned before, with the police as well, was to assist those who are responsible for the reform process to work together more effectively. There I do think we did succeed. That's a much more limited objective and in time and in space. And also the number of people that we were trying to target, if you talk about 70 officers in the initial group, they were predominantly the officers responsible for the reform process. So I think we did have some success there, and I think the reform process went relatively smoothly. On the Army side, you can talk to the officers themselves, but I think we had enormous success in assisting the reform process in its efficiency and effectiveness. They were already there, and they had good people from ex-CNDD, FTD, ex-PMPA, ex-FAB. And they also had the resources. Unlike the police, unfortunately, the police have had to scrounge a little bit more. They don't have the same amount of resources available to them that the Army does. They don't have the same infrastructure to build upon that the Army has had. So they have a much more difficult row to hoe, in fact. I think that's it's much more challenging for the National Police in many ways. But I would say big success there. In terms of sustainability and integrating the training into structures, we've had much less success there. I'm not discouraged as yet, however, although we would need, again, more funding to make sure it really happens effectively. This year, for the first time, we had really good progress on the FDN side, as I told you, so now it really looks like it will be integrated into NSCOM, and there's a couple people who've been trained as trainers I've now worked with them for 2 years, who are responsible for training and specialized training within the Army at the Etat-Major. And so that's what you really want. Unfortunately, Emmanuel has been invited several times and just not been able to attend, not by his own volition, but just by circumstances. So the commissaire of training for the police hasn't yet. He's heard a lot about it. He's come here. He wants to promote it. But again, it's harder when he's got many things on his plate. And I think while this is an important program, it's not one of their top priorities. So I would say mixed results. I think better with more limited objectives on very specifically a period of time in how to get the reform process moving at a very sensitive time in Burundi's history. You know, if you think of 2005 before the elections, that was not an easy period. Same is true for the Army. So there, I think, yes, less mixed results in terms of trying to get it integrated into an overall program.
What are some of the ways you do evaluate your programs and the impact of it?
Mm-hmm. Two major ways we've done it. Of course, we do an evaluation sort of at the end of every workshop. That's more kind of, is this appropriate? Is it appropriately adapted to you as an individual participant? So then we take that and try to use the comments after every workshop and improve future workshops, structure, ordering of exercises, changing, adapting exercises, etc. So that's one way. The second way has been with both, we've done three major evaluations. One was an evaluation of the work we did that was funded by the World Bank. Second was one we did at our own instigation of the work with the Army, and then the same with the police. And there we did, so for example, the one with the police has just been finalized, but that took place essentially over 3 months, sort of October, November, September, October, November of last year, where there's a survey that was distributed and collected, so questions formulated around leadership retention. The survey was distributed to trained and untrained officers, and then a set of interviews with a smaller cohort, but with some very specific questions to see has there been retention. And the group was chosen, of course, not simply from those trained in 2007, but also those trained in 2005. So that we would have some comparison over time in terms of what has there been impact, and if so, what in their view, and by trained as well as untrained officers. So you could compare, because a trained person will always say, because they're also talking to you, I mean, I didn't conduct, we had an independent person come and do the evaluation, but they'll say, you know, they want to satisfy you, they want you to feel happy about things.
So second part of the interview with Elizabeth McClintock. So we're talking about the evaluation tools.
So I think if you ask somebody who's been trained, do they feel their leadership skills have changed? Of course, they'll assess themselves generally quite positively. So that for us, it was important to have this other cohort of untrained officers sort of making a comment on their trained colleagues, but also on their own perception of their own leadership capacity, and then you can calibrate a bit responses to the questions, and get, I think, a more realistic sense of if there's been much of an impact. So that's how we evaluated the work today.
Were there any major lessons drawn from?
Well, as I mentioned right at the beginning, interestingly, I think the biggest lessons or the skills that are retained, there's one tool, which is something called the four quadrant tool, which people, as I mentioned, it's very simple to use, but it's a very effective analysis of a problem. You just simply somewhat, it's not the same as a SWOT analysis, but it is as easy to use. So you just sort of identify the problem, identify the causes, prioritize, and then identify general solutions and come up with an action plan in a bit more detail. But so that's one of the tools that was identified as being very useful and used frequently. And I think it's because of its ease in use. It doesn't take a long time. And the other, frankly, big impact was in communication skills, as I mentioned earlier. The active listening and the ability to take the time to listen even to your subordinates, and the role that effective communication has in, frankly, getting your orders followed effectively, improving the functioning of your team, morale, etc., that came out very strongly. That the communication skills aspect of the training was rated most highly, I would say. With the Army, then one follow-on question was then the impact on the reform process, and then that was also very, that yes, this had an extremely positive impact on the reform and integration process of the Army. In the police, that came out less strongly, and I think it's also due to timing. When we did it for the Army, we worked with them at a very much more just after the ceasefire agreement through 2004 and then in 2006, so after the election. So that was a bit more sensitive in terms of timing, whereas now training another cohort of officers in 2007 and training trainers in 2007 for the police, I think the urgency is not quite, people are much more comfortable with how Burundi is, that the reform process is going. It may not be working as effectively as we would like, but a lot of those very difficult steps had already been taken. So we don't hear the same sort of feedback in terms of hard-hitting impact on the reform process. And I think that is related to whom we worked with at what moment and when we did the evaluation, et cetera. So.
One last question on training. It's often said that training, especially when done by the international community, is quite expensive. Do you have any cost-saving suggestions from your experience?
It can be expensive. I think one cost-saving measure that we took, it's been much more cost-effective that I live here and I'm here full-time, because it's much easier to respond to. My costs here are lower than they might be otherwise, honestly, than all the per diem and the cost of the plane flights and all that. In fact, we added a couple of activities under the DFID grant after I made the decision to move here. That was not in the original proposal. And so we were able to take that money and put it towards...
Versus bringing in consultants.
Coming and going, which is what I'd been doing before, I think. And then, of course, training up Burundians. It takes a while. It's a long-term investment. I think it would be an interesting question to ask of Fabian, who's now one of our really excellent trainers. But it's taken time for even... And some of that is related to many of his other responsibilities. He probably would have come... He would have become more effective much more quickly had training been the only thing that he does. But he runs this organization, so it's not, it's like one of many responsibilities that he has. But I think training Burundians is the way to go. At the beginning, we couldn't have used Burundians. We had two Burundians, Fabian and Nsengimana and Eugene Indorera, who were our consultants to the team, who had very sort of impeccable reputations as far as Burundians were concerned. But Burundians in the room didn't want Burundians in front of them doing the training. It was still too sensitive at the time we started the project. Now, that's not true anymore. Now, Burundians absolutely can do the training, and it's a question of making sure that they're, you know, they've got the resources to do it. But in 2003, that really wasn't possible.
Last question. You mentioned that, for instance, the experience of workshops in the provinces with people bounding outside of their training room was positive. Are there any other experiments or innovations that you know of or you've been directly involved with that you think merit more attention?
I think there are too many. One of the things we had, which I thought was important, and I didn't mention this before, but when we did the initial group of officers in 2005, CivPol was involved. And I think one thing that we didn't do well enough there was we didn't have enough coordination with CivPol. We could have had a better...
The UN police.
Yes. We could have had a better coordination with them, which would have, I think, reinforced their own activities as well as our own. Because... there were some things that we did that were similar, things that were totally different that, you know, they were offering, just as the Belgians and the French are and the Dutch are, more sort of police-specific training. Yet one of the roles of course, the UN police is to also enhance the peace process and the prospects for peace. And we ultimately were very satisfied with the relationship that we had with Diallo and with the UN police, and we could have done a better job on that. I think collaboration, you know, you hear about it all the time and people talk about it all the time, but it is critical. It's critical to the success of the program. And I had two UN police observers at the training of trainers with the police in December, and I think that was very helpful, but then we don't have follow-on to that. There's nothing, that's unfortunately too sort of periodic and not regular. It's kind of a one-off thing for that kind of collaboration, and that has to change. Otherwise, I think the resources aren't well spent.
Any last comment?
All right. I think so.
This is my conclusion. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.